Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. The Rules of Investing gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, and it's brought to you by Livewire Markets. Today's guest is Chris Rands, Portfolio Manager for Fixed Income at Nikko Asset Management Australia. The Nikko Australian Bond Fund that Chris works on was last year one of the top performing funds in its category. Chris has an in-depth understanding of the Australian economy and should be able to offer some valuable insights into the state of markets in this time of crisis. In this episode, we discuss the stability of Australia's banks and insurance companies, how COVID-19 has affected his view on housing, and his take on how bad the recession could get. If you're an iTunes or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to be notified whenever I post content. Not a Livewire subscriber yet? Just head on over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from the leading investment minds in the country. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Chris, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us at what is no doubt a crazy time for all investors, whether you're in bond markets, credit markets, equity markets, or elsewhere. It's been a pretty wild ride since I recorded my last podcast at the beginning of March. Traditionally, I open the podcast with a bit of a getting to know you question. Often, I ask people about their experience in the GFC or the tech wreck or the 87 crash, depending on their level of experience in the stock markets. But given the obvious crisis that we've all been facing in recent weeks, I thought I'd put a bit of a different twist on that question and ask you about the current crisis that we're experiencing. So I was wondering if you could tell us, when did you first realize that COVID-19 would be an issue for markets and for economies? And what was it that first kind of sparked that realization for you?
Yeah, so there was really, I think, two things that got us thinking that it was going to be bigger than we had previously thought. The first of those, the realization really came in late February that it was not being contained to China. So I think there was this assumption sitting there for a while that as long as it can be quarantined within China, that it's going to be okay. As soon as it started spreading into Italy and Spain, that's when we stepped back and thought, oh, this is probably going to spread across the world and our assumptions could well be wrong here. So at that point in time, we actually kind of started moving the position around in the fund a little bit. So we had been positioned for rising interest rates. At that point in time, we thought that's definitely not going to happen now. We need to face the other way. And the other thing that was quite interesting at that point in time, to me anyway, was that credit was still on its tights. And while we hadn't seen it spread into kind of the more broader sectors, a lot of the Asian issuers were still coming relatively low yields. And so I actually kind of started trying to reduce some of our exposure to those Asian issuers before the markets really started correcting. So that was really, I guess, when we kind of first started figuring it out. And then I would say the second thing that really kind of got me nervous was the Saudi Arabia announcement that they were going to increase oil production. This one's probably a little bit off track from COVID, but at the time, you know, we were thinking credit probably not going to do too well in this environment. And a big part of the high yield energy index is oil. About 20% of that index is oil. So as soon as the oil price started falling, that's when we thought, oh, this really doesn't need to come right now.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up that issue of oil, because almost at any other time in history, a fall of that magnitude in oil markets would be the main thing on most investors' minds. the level of the falls, I mean, the oil price fell to levels that have rarely been seen in the last, you know, 40, 50 years. Do you think, even though it's not a direct link, it seems to me that perhaps the behaviour by the Russian players there was a touch opportunistic and maybe taking advantage of the crisis as an opportunity to gain, you know, market share and to negatively affect their competitors. Was that your take on it as well?
Yeah, that was my feeling, I think, in the sense of we were obviously already going through a demand shock. You know, oil consumption in China had already shown those force majeure clauses, I think, back in January that was. Everything feels so long ago now. But basically you had this demand shock and then on top of that you got this supply shock, and to me it did look like it was an opportunistic time to try and shake some of the marginal players out, and perhaps they didn't think it was going to be as violent as it was. But that Monday when we came in, you know, the oil price opened like 30% down and it was just like, wow, something big is going on here.
Well, we're starting to get the first kind of hints of economic data from the developed world kind of post-shutdown. We obviously saw the crazy jobless figures in the US over the last couple of weeks that have seen approximately 10 million Americans out of jobs, which is really a difficult kind of number to wrap your head around. I'm wondering if you've made any attempts to quantify the level of contraction that we should expect to see this quarter, and if you have, what were some of the learnings you took away from that?
Yeah, so I started this process a little while ago, and I probably should preface this with I don't really make point in time forecasts. A lot of what I try to do is pick the direction of the economy and then compare that to where the narrative is focusing. So basically when I started this process of looking at what could occur, it was kind of mid-February. The process here was to break down GDP into sectors, look at the size of each sector, and then kind of think about just how disruptive it could be. So, you know, a simple example here would be retail trade is about 4.5%, accommodation and food is about 3%. You know, you start kind of moving those backwards to the 70-80% that the market has been talking about in the shutdown in foot traffic and stuff like that, and you're definitely kind of looking in that 5% range. More recently though, I think it's kind of important to step back and kind of ask, does quarter three even really matter here? It's going to be weak. I think we all know it's going to be weak because you take a quick walk around outside and you'll see that absolutely nothing is open. So if it's down 5, 10, 15, to me, nothing I think would probably really shock me. I think it's more important when I've been looking at this process to say, just how long is it going to last? So to me, the real question here is not what's the damage in Q3, it's how long do we think this is going to linger? And that is going to be a far harder question to answer than just breaking down the GDP and looking for an effect, because, you know, that's a relatively simple and archaic way of just looking at it.
There's been a lot of talk about different shapes of recoveries, whether they be V-shaped, U-shaped, or even the dreaded L-shape, although I hesitate to use the word recovery if we're talking about an L-shape. That doesn't really imply much of a recovery, no. In my view. I understand, obviously, we're pretty early on in the crisis still, but do you have a view yet as to which one of those kind of outcomes is likely to be your base case at this point?
Yeah, I think the most honest answer for me to say here is I don't know. You know, it would be nice if it was a V, it'd be nice if it's a U compared to an L, but at the moment I really can't gauge what the effects are going to be, simply because typically when I go and do this sort of analysis, I try to look for things in the past that we can kind of find lessons from or examples and use that to gauge our thinking. And there's just nothing that I think you can really go and look at to make that assumption. So the types of things, I guess, that are sitting in my mind at the moment if we think about whether it can linger. The first of those is just when is the isolation going to end? You know, there's been a little bit of talk that it could occur in June. There's been talk that the disease won't be really kind of out of the way until October. So if it goes from June to October, you kind of need to start to ask the question, well, which corporates can survive a 6-month shutdown? How does that affect future employment? How does it affect their willingness to spend and invest once they come back? The other thing that is really sitting in my mind at the moment is once we come out of this, let's say, for example, we open back up in June, does the government need to keep international travel closed for some time? Because I think the last thing you'd want to see is to go through 3 months of economic pain to open up the borders and then have the disease find its way back in straight away. So I think when you kind of start to look at all these things, there's just 1,000 unanswered questions. My feeling at the moment is it's probably going to be more U-like than the V-shape, but I just have no real way of knowing just how quickly employment's going to come back once we open, because there's going to be too many unknowns, I think.
Yeah, it's a really fair point, and there seems to be a lot of people out there talking with a lot of confidence about what's going on, and I just don't think confidence is something you can really have in such an environment at the moment. You know, going back to your point about the comparisons to comparisons to prior periods of crisis, probably the best one I've seen is a comparison to the 1918 flu epidemic, but even that is incredibly flawed. We were operating under a completely different monetary system. Our monetary and fiscal policy was just absolutely not comparable in any way, and we were just coming out the back end of a war rather than coming off, you know, an all-time high. So it's certainly hard to find you can find kind of bits and pieces here and there. You can make very specific niche comparisons, but trying to find any kind of broad-based comparison seems to be just about impossible.
Yeah, I think that's probably the correct way of describing it. You know, you're patching together a few different things that makes sense, and then you're not quite sure whether it all adds up. The other thing that I think goes into looking at this as well is, you know, you can kind of make a forecast for Australia coming out of it quickly, but then it's still uncertain, you know, what happens in Europe. It's still uncertain what happens in the US, and obviously that's going to affect global growth and global trade. So, you know, you're not just making a forecast about Australia, you're also trying to think about the world at the same time.
Let's talk a little bit closer to home. I mean that in the literal sense, if you'll excuse the pun. You published an article on Livewire in early March. I'm guessing it was probably written in February, mentioning that low interest rates could provide a backdrop for strong gains in housing if the market's attention doesn't get too focused on COVID-19. Now, obviously, the market's attention has gotten very focused on COVID-19. So it was a good caveat. So I'm curious, just, you know, obviously, it not only has the market gotten focused on COVID-19, but it's become almost a singular point of discussion. I read recently that 90% of news stories at the moment mention COVID-19 compared to about 30% for the bushfires, which is, you know, really quite stunning. So, with that being said, how has your view on housing changed?
Yeah, so that article that you're referring to, that was kind of written at that late February time when our view was shifting. At that point in time, I think the assumption sitting behind that was that we would be able to avoid the isolation and the quarantine, which obviously in hindsight is a pretty bad assumption to be making.
Well, you can only make assumptions based on the information available at the time, can't you?
Yeah. I think at the time, you know, we mostly were thinking that the West would not take as drastic actions as we had seen in China. And you know, that in hindsight is wrong. And I think with that, we need to rethink that housing idea. So typically when I look at housing, generally I see two scenarios that is the big risk to Australian housing. So the first of that is interest rates rise quickly. So there's a lot of household debt out there at the moment. And if interest rates were to go up quickly, I think that would really hurt house prices. I think it's pretty safe to assume that one's off the table at the moment. But the other one is that unemployment spikes. So when we were writing this, I think the idea was that, you know, we'd take a bit of a hit to an economy, but there wasn't going to be a complete shutdown. And in that environment, employment would probably be okay. I think now when you're looking at this, it's pretty safe to say the base case is unemployment is going to spike drastically. So the outlook now, I would say, has shifted very quickly to say housing's probably going to come under pressure here. And it's going to be because a lot of people have lost their jobs, and the fact of when it will get better would be around how long does that unemployment last. Now, when you say that, there's still some small benefits here in the offset. So the stimulus package from the government, I think, has been quite good. The JobKeeper payments that they have introduced, I think, are very good for the economy and a good way of keeping people surviving through this crisis, with the benefit of if we get through it, you know, you have a job you can go back to, and that should help ease arrears in the housing sector and keep forced sellers kind of having to come to market when there's no buyers because everybody's stuck inside. And the other small positive here is the banks are going to be offering loan forbearance. So if this is a 3 to 6 month crisis, then you don't have to sell your house. You can kind of take a bit of a holiday, so to speak, on the payments and then pick up where you left off a little bit later. But all of this is with the preface that people come back to work after the fact, which kind of takes you back to those questions I was mentioning before of, you know, how long is it going to last? How fast are people going to get back into their jobs? That's going to be what really drives the outlook from here. But I think, you know, being honest with what we said and what we're looking at now is that positive of low rates is being offset by a big spike in unemployment, and that's not going to be good for the housing market.
Staying on the Australian economy, obviously, through any time of crisis, banks and insurance companies being levered to asset markets and to economies have a susceptibility to coming into strife in times like this. But certainly the perception and, you know, what APRA has said over the years is that our banks and presumably insurance companies too, very, very strong, very well capitalized. So, I mean, how true is that, first of all? Are they as well capitalized as we're told? And do you think that they will be able to withstand a severe recession without needing to be bailed out by the government?
So, the Australian banks are far better capitalized than they were when we went into the GFC. So that at least is a positive, and they have some of the strongest capital levels in the world. So for example, I went and had a bit of a dig, and if you look at CBA's leverage ratio, for example, it's sitting at around 6%. So, you know, you think back to GFC when you know, the numbers where these companies were 40, 50 times levered, it's in a far better position than it was then. So we're starting from a stronger point, and we don't also have kind of, you know, the structured products that had been pushed around all through the financial sector to waiting to blow up. Can they withstand a recession though? I think, like many of these things, it's going to depend what assumptions you throw at it. If you look at the Australian banking system, you know, it has some of the highest exposures in the world to residential property. So what you're really thinking about is that prior question we were talking about of how does a prolonged recession hit unemployment, and how does that affect the property market and then the banks following on from that. My kind of feeling here is if it's a kind of short, sharp recession where we have a drop and then we come back relatively quickly, I think they're probably relatively fine in that case. Sure, profits are going to be hit, but they are well capitalized at the moment, so that should be relatively okay. The risk would be that it is a sharp recession that just doesn't recover, where unemployment lingers and people do eventually have to sell their homes. That would be the risk where I think we might find some of these assumptions being tested. But I don't think that would really be people's base case of what is going to occur at the moment. My feeling as well is because of the recent policies from the government, you know, the JobKeeper policy that we talked about, the the ability to kind of quickly get money into the hands of the people that have been hurt the most from this. It probably blunts the impact a little bit because, you know, you're getting a bit of payments to be able to at least stay alive and not have to, you know, basically go under instantly, which is very good. So I think from that point of view, a short, sharp recession is going to be fine, and it's the longer one that you need to be thinking about. But I don't think really many people are making the assumption that this is going to be a long, drawn-out affair at the moment.
I was reading the latest note from Howard Marks last week, and he was quoting some pretty crazy statistics about credit markets in America during March. He was saying that basically credit markets completely shut off for the first few weeks of March. No deals were done. Liquidity was non-existent. And then at the end of March, just as equity markets kind of rallied along with it, they saw one of the busiest weeks on record in corporate credit markets, which is the wild swings. You usually associate those with equity markets. You don't usually think of credit markets as being, you know, wild, volatile, you know, ups and downs. But what are you seeing in credit markets in Australia? Is it a similar story there? What's going on there? We don't, as retail investors, we don't really get a lot of visibility on those markets.
Yeah. So that is a good question to think about. And the US experience was probably a little bit more wild than it was here, in the sense that they have a very big high yield market where we do not. So our credit market is mostly investment grade, which is higher credit quality. But having said that, our market essentially also was shut for a few weeks there, and there was very little liquidity. So when you think about the credit market, what you're actually getting paid for in that market is default risk. So, you know, in a government bond, you might get 1%. If you buy some credit, it might be 2.5%. And that extra yield that you're taking is for the fact that corporates could default. If we look at the current environment at the moment, this is the first time you've really had to think about default risk probably for the past 10 years. So when you think about what occurred in the US, the shutdown in that market was really reflecting the fact that investors didn't really have much certainty around the economy. We're not certain who is going to be exposed to this. And so as a sector at large, basically it just shut down. Now, when you look going forward here, I think the question that you really need to ask if you're thinking about if investing in credit is who's going to survive. So because you're getting compensated for default risk, you can kind of start to look around the economy and look at corporate names and say, do I think they're going to survive this environment? Now, you know, the simplest place to start there is to say, look at the airlines. You know, some of those airlines showed signs of stress basically in the first week of shutting down. But then you can kind of start inching out from that and say, okay, well, what do you think about the airports? What do you think about car manufacturers? What do you think about retail shopping if the shops stay shut for some time? And so you can kind of start to see why it started as kind of a little bit of selling and rolled into something far bigger once everything got shut down, because you just don't know who's going to be exposed here. So until there's some certainty around economic conditions and whose profitability is going to be okay through this period, I think you're going to see the credit markets remain kind of troubled, so to speak, and spreads remain wide. And then just to kind of finish that, the last point to make there is the reason that a lot of that US market stopped seizing up was that the Fed came in and started purchasing credit. So basically the Fed said, nobody really wants to buy this at the moment. We're going to help backstop this market so that our companies can fund themselves, and we're going to help investors out. And that's really what brought the market back to life, because suddenly there was a big player that could backstop a lot of the issuance.
Obviously, as a result of the central bank interventions that you just mentioned there, bond yields are incredibly low, lower than they've ever been. I mean, we've been saying that for a long time now. It seems like it's been the theme of markets for the last 5 or 10 years now is that bond yields being at new all-time lows, and they're always seeming to get lower and lower. But of course, that's provided a boost for bond investors. If you look at the time that I wrote the question, the Bloomberg Ausbond 0+ year index was up 9% over the previous 12 months, which is pretty incredible when you consider that yields are only, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4% on most bonds and high-grade credit. So, given that yields are so low now, are bonds, and I'm specifically talking about government bonds here, putting credit to aside, are they still attractive at these kind of prices? And, you know, is it possible we're going to see further repeats of that kind of performance?
Yeah, so I probably should start by saying, similar to what you mentioned, that my entire career now in fixed income, I've been told that it's a bad investment because yields are so low. So typically, I don't put much kind of emphasis on the yield story, and I look more at what we think the drivers are going to be and what that would mean for returns. So having said that, I don't think returns in fixed income this year will be as strong as they were over the past 12 months, because the ability for rates to drop is going to be limited. If you look at what the RBA is telling us with the cash rate, they are saying that they expect to be able to keep it around these levels, and that they don't see the need for negative rates in Australia. So if we make the assumption that negative rates in Australia are not going to happen, so that would be another big question that we probably could spend a long time discussing it. But if we make that assumption, then kind of 0 to 7 year fixed income in the government bond market, the returns are probably going to be pretty similar to where the yields are now. And that means you're likely not going to see the returns that you did over the past kind of 12 to 24 months, because that was really about yields falling aggressively with the cash rate cuts. Now, if we kind of step back and we say, so why would it be attractive then to own it? I can kind of lay out three ideas that I think kind of still feed into this and get you away from saying yields are low and therefore you just should never own it. So the first of those is long-dated government bonds are still yielding about 1.5%. So that's about one and a bit over cash. And the RBA has told us that they're going to be keeping the cash rate there for some time, and they're willing to buy bonds if the market gets dislocated. So in that kind of long-dated bond market, there's still a decent pickup there, and you're still kind of operating with the assumption that the RBA is willing to backstop it if things really start blowing up. The other thing that I think feeds into this is that if they're going to be holding the cash rate down to support the market, which is what they've told us, again, while fixed income returns probably won't put up the big returns that they have over the past 12 months, then you've still got low and stable yields, which might be attractive relative to cash. And then the last thing that I would kind of say here is that if the economy worsens, if that this turns out not to be a V-style recovery, if it turns out to be a U or an L, then my expectation would be that corporate profits are going to continue to fall for longer than expected. And in that environment, fixed income, particularly in the government space, is going to be a relatively defensive asset. So if you look at the returns, even year to date, fixed income's done a bit under 3% for the composite index. So while March wasn't great, if you are thinking that this is going to be a prolonged slowdown, it still does have a role as a defensive asset.
Well, let's put it all to work in some practical senses. Within your universe of investable assets, where are you putting money to work at the moment?
So what we see at the moment is that the kind of best part of the bond curve opening up at the moment is the long-dated governments. So because the RBA has been buying out to about 10 years, those yields have all kind of compressed in, and then the long-dated government bond yields have just drifted higher. So you're actually getting a fair bit of pickup for going out into that long end. And typically, you would probably expect that if the RBA gets control of the bond market, that those spreads kind of start to compress as people start looking for where they're going to find yield again. Now, the risk to this view, obviously, is that the federal government is going to be issuing a ton of new bonds to finance the spending that they're doing. And if they want to do it out in the long-dated government bond market, then there's going to be a lot of supply. And that typically leads to higher yields because they're going to be pushing more bonds out there. That's obviously the risk, but I think you're getting justified with the yield pickup to take that risk at the moment.
Conversely, are there any areas that you're looking to lighten your exposure or be underweight at the moment?
At the moment, we're not really kind of moving anything around, but the area that we're kind of most standoffish from is long-dated credit. So if you think back to the credit default risk that I talked about, you're getting paid for the risk that these companies can repay you. And if we go into an economic environment that is worse than the market is currently expecting, then that long-dated credit, I think, will be the part that remains under pressure. So at the moment, until we kind of see how long this is going to last, what the effect is going to be, and really understand how quickly employment is going to come back into the economy, we're standoffish from long-dated credit simply because we don't know if it's going to repay us or not. And the real risk in fixed income is typically not that interest rates rise, it's that someone defaults and can't pay you back anything. So that's kind of the place that we're most wary of.
All about that return of capital rather than return on your capital.
Exactly, yes.
That's the main part of our interview done, but I've got some favourite questions that I asked each one of my guests.
Yep.
So we've got a few minutes left. I will jump into those now. This one seems particularly appropriate at the moment, given all the extra reading time that people and watching time that people will have. But could you share with us something you've read, watched, or listened to recently? It could be a book, article, research, podcast, anything like that, that really impressed you or really made you think?
Yeah, so something that I've been kind of thinking about a lot at the moment is an idea that was brought up in a book called Thinking in Bets. So that book is actually written by a professional poker player. And what she writes about is that when you look at the decision-making process, you need to split out the how well the decision was made versus the ultimate outcome. Because there's so much luck associated with life, you need to make sure that the decision-making that you're doing is good. And so if we think about the current environment, it's quite interesting, I think, to kind of sit back and say, okay, this is the information that I had going into this in January and February. Here is the decision that I made off these facts. How much of that was a good decision versus the final outcome? Because we know the outcome now, but it wasn't certain in January and February. And I think it's a good time, given everybody has a bit of extra time probably at home, to go back and look at those decisions that you made and say, with the information you had, would you make them again? And that's with the benefit of knowing the outcome, but it is also important to say, can we improve our decision-making process for the future?
If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give your younger self a single piece of investing advice, what would it be?
I think for me, given I'm in the bond market, I'm typically a pretty conservative guy. So I think the advice would be to have more conviction personally in some of the offbeat ideas that I've had. So over the past 5 years, I've actually thought for quite a while interest rates would end up down here. There was kind of a lot of structural things that had us thinking that. And if I could go back, I think the idea would be to say, when you have conviction in an idea like that, you should look for ways that you can implement it outside of fixed income, rather than just looking at it in the conservative nature that you focus on.
Now, before I ask this last question, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting that anybody goes out there, puts all their money into a single stock and forgets about it for 5 years. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. And now, Chris, I also will acknowledge as well, I know you're not an equities guy, so I'm not expecting a typical answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway and we'll see where it takes us. So, with all that being said, if the markets were going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would it be?
Yeah, so I guess as given I'm not an equity man and I'd never really focus on it, I'll come from this in a different bent. If I was personally looking at this for the next 5 years, I think I would be really thinking about whether the long-dated bonds make sense versus cash. So if we expect that the RBA is going to be holding the cash rate at 0.25 for the next kind of 3 to 5 years, I actually think there's going to be better performance from long-dated bonds, particularly semi-governments. So there's no default risk basically in a semi-government. So we know it's going to be money good. And at the moment, there's a sizable pickup to cash. So I think if I was just going to be leaving my money anywhere, that's where I'd be putting it at the moment.
Chris, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today. It's been really interesting getting some insights into the Australian economy and the credit markets. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
It's my pleasure and thank you for having me.